Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. The last time I was here teaching the Dhamma class, the Sutta class, one of the participants here asked me to do the go through the Samaditi Sutta, number 9. So this is what we're going to do today. Unfortunately, I found out that the person who asked for this is now over in India on pilgrimage. Nevertheless, they can still have the opportunity to listen to the exposition on the recording. It is an important sutta, the Samaditi Sutta, simply because it shows the fundamental teachings of Buddhism, such as the Four Noble Truths, cause and effect, and more importantly, the links of dependent origination, in a form where cause and effect is the most important. It's a framework which is repeated again and again in each one of these sections, and the framework is something which many of you recognize as the framework of the Four Noble Truths. What the thing is, what its cause is, what its end is, and the fact there is an end to it. So this fourfold framework: the thing, its cause, its end, and the cause for its ending. And this is all about cause and effect. So this is the essence of the right view of this particular sutta. And there's many important parts of Buddhism which are contained in this, which is why it is a very well-known sutta. So here we go, the prologue. Thus have I heard on one occasion the Blessed One was living at Sarvati in Jeta's Grove, Anathapindika's Park. There the Venerable Sariputta addressed the monks thus, "Friends, monks." "Friend," they replied, the Venerable Sariputta said this, "One of right view, one of right view," he said, "friends. In what way is a noble disciple one of right view, whose view is straight, who has perfect confidence in the Dhamma and has arrived at this true Dhamma?" That's a prologue, and the usual response would be from the monks, "Indeed, friend, we would come from a far away to learn from the Venerable Sariputta the meaning of this statement. It would be good if the Venerable Sariputta would explain the meaning of this statement. Having heard it from him, the monks will remember it." "Then, friends, listen and attend closely to what I shall say." "Yes, friend," the monks replied, and the Venerable Sariputta said this. So standard opening to a sutta. So if ever monks like me or Sister Wayama ask you a question, you should reply, "Indeed, Sister Ajahn Wayama, we would come from far away to learn this meaning of this statement." So that's the right way to answer a monk or a nun. Anyway, here we go. So he's talking about the meaning of one of right view. It doesn't actually say right view, one of right view. So it's really describing the person rather than the thing. The wholesome and the unwholesome. These two words are kusala and akusala. We have no real word for evil in Buddhism, but the closest we can have is like unwholesome, like akusala. And instead of like good, we have this like wholesome, good, skillful is sometimes the word, word's translation. But certainly we haven't got anything which is the same as the Judeo-Christian word of evil. It's just unskillful, stupid, silly thing to do, but not evil. "When, friends, a noble disciple understands the unwholesome and the root of the unwholesome, the cause, and the wholesome and the root of the wholesome, in that way they are one of right view, whose view is straight, who has perfect confidence in the Dhamma and has arrived at this true Dhamma." So what is, friends, is the unwholesome, you know, the bad, not evil, just, you know, unskillful. What is the root of the unwholesome? What is the wholesome? What is the root of the unwholesome, of the wholesome? So first of all, the bad stuff. Killing living beings is akusala. Taking what is not given is akusala. Misconduct in sensual pleasures is akusala. False speech or lying is akusala. Malicious speech is akusala. Harsh speech is akusala. Gossip is akusala. Covetousness is akusala. Ill will is akusala. And wrong view is akusala. This is called the unwholesome, otherwise known as akusala. Now, first of all, you will see that these are some interesting things in this list. First of all, you have the first four of the five precepts. But the fifth precept is missing in there. And it doesn't say anything about taking alcohol or non-medicinal drugs. And why do you think that is? Why do you think that's missed out from this thing? Are they saying that taking alcohol is not unskillful? It's a good thing to do. Why do you reckon? Yeah. Lynn. Sorry, I mean, I think we all missed the opportunity here. Didn't you hear what I first said? You should have said, Venerable Sir, indeed we would come from far away to learn from the Venerable the meaning of the statement. That's okay, Lynn, I was only teasing. But yeah, now I think the reason is because my take on this is that when one takes like alcohol and gets drunk, it means the other four, whether it's like killing living beings or taking what's not given, lying or especially misconduct in sensual pleasures, that almost becomes an effect of being drunk or taking alcohol. So it's almost like that these are the unwholesome things, and it's what not actually so much taking alcohol, but what alcohol does to you. It makes you sort of break all these precepts. So I would propose that one of the reasons it's not in here is that because it's understood that to be able to keep away from these unwholesome things, then if you take drugs and alcohol, you lose your mindfulness, you don't know what you're doing, and therefore that you will commit these unwholesome things. So I see that the alcohol is almost like a cause of these unwholesome things, rather than an unwholesome thing in itself. Okay, you don't understand it. Maybe it's because it's too hot. I think it's maybe because each one of these killing living beings, taking what's not given, misconduct in sensuous pleasures, false speech, those four are like a harmful to other people. Taking alcohol, you're harming yourself. But it needs to be said that when you take alcohol, it's not just harming yourself, you're opening yourself up to the likelihood that you will commit any of those first four unwholesome actions. So it's almost like a cause of the unwholesome rather than an unwholesome thing in itself. Maybe. But anyhow, after the fourth speech, instead of going to the fifth precept, we go off to other types of unskillful speech. We have malicious speech, and this is explained in the monks' rules of the Vinaya, the rules they have to keep. Malicious speech is, in particular, malicious gossip. When you hear someone say one thing, and you use that to create disharmony, to create splits, to create tensions within a community. So it is more like malicious gossip. Bearing tales, telling someone else, have you heard, you know, what Ashley said about you this morning, Lynn? Now, Ashley said very nice things about you, but if I, if he did say something wrong, then I go and tell someone else. So that would be malicious speech. That's why that I think I once translated that as malicious tale-bearing. When you tell tales, but with malice. And the reason why that is included in here is because certainly in the monastic sangha and also within any community, harmony was recognized as such an important part of the happiness of the community and its prosperity, that harmony was paramount. So we wouldn't sort of a good thing there. Like you would actually probably call the cartoons, you might call that malicious speech, the Muhammad cartoons, simply because if it was done with malice to divide communities, to create problems and troubles, then that would come under malicious speech or malicious actions. Harsh speech is actually when we talk to each other in very cruel or personal terms. So you call someone like fatso, or you call someone like you've got a face like a pig. Speech like that, which is demeaning, which is personal, which is there to upset the other person, that is what's the meaning of harsh speech. Even like shouting at a person, swearing at a person, that is harsh speech. That's its meaning. And the last one, gossip here. Gossip doesn't mean just sharing a joke. Gossip means like speech which hasn't got any proper meaning to it. It's just speaking for speaking's sake, rather than there's a point to it. And sometimes the point to it is just being allowing another person to unwind. Sometimes it's allowing a person to create some fellowship. So it's okay to sit around the coffee table and just enjoy each other's fellowship. But if it's just speaking for speaking's sake, then that is called gossip. And covetousness, again, is another word for greed, for wanting. Ill will is very easy to understand. And wrong view itself is unwholesome. This is called the unwholesome. And the next one, what is the root of the unwholesome, the cause? Now, why do people do these things? And here we come across something which was stressed in the forest tradition as something the monks should really look out for, is the three, what they call kilesas, the roots of the unwholesome. That's greed, hatred, and delusion. The three roots of the unwholesome. Greed, hatred, and delusion. What particular type of delusion do you think it means there? We would come a long way, Ajahn Mahārāja, in answer to that. Obviously, the roots of delusion is, first of all, the self-view, the idea of ownership of me and mine. The second part of delusion is the misunderstanding of what's suffering and what's happiness, taking what's suffering to be happiness, taking what's happiness to be suffering. And lastly, that taking what's impermanent to be permanent, and what's permanent to be impermanent, whatever it is. So there, you see, that's a delusion, when we think that this belongs to me, or I want that. All coming from the sense of craving, misunderstanding what happiness truly is, and misunderstanding the law of impermanence. That's called delusion. That makes sense to everybody? Any comments about that? Okay. And the opposite here, what is the wholesome? What's called kusala. And it is just the direct opposite of these things. Abstention from giving living beings is wholesome. Abstention from taking what is not given is wholesome. Abstention from misconduct in sensual pleasures is wholesome. Abstention from false speech is wholesome. Abstention from malicious speech is wholesome. Abstention from harsh speech is wholesome. Abstention from gossip, from covetousness, from non-ill will is wholesome. And right view is wholesome. This is called the wholesome. And what is the root of the wholesome? Non-greed, non-hate, and non-delusion. This is called the root of the wholesome. It doesn't actually say very much there, but it was understood that the opposites of each one of these things is not so much a non-doing, but a doing of the opposite. As it says very clearly in the right efforts, it's not a case of not doing anything which is wrong, but doing what is good. Because by doing what is good, by perfecting the opposites of each one of these things, that's the best way of removing the opportunity to do unwholesome things. So the abstention from killing living beings is always understood to mean compassion to all living beings, looking out for their safety. In other words, if you see the snail on the path, you pick it up and move it so it doesn't get into trouble anymore. So it's not just a non-doing, but a positive responsibility for the welfare of other living beings. And the same with the opposite of taking what it's not given. It doesn't mean just not taking other things, but also means one is generous, one actually gives to others. And abstention from misconduct in sensual pleasures doesn't mean that you sort of become celibate. It means that you have a trusting, caring relationship if you're a layperson. And abstention from false speech and malicious speech, harsh speech and gossip, it means the opposite of those things is obviously always speaking. Not doesn't mean not speaking at all, but being truthful. And not being a talebearer. Someone, they say the opposite of this is someone who delights in harmony, so much so that you would never tell tales to cause a split between friends or a split between communities. And obviously the opposite of covetousness, which is your own greed, is learning how to live simply with a bit of renunciation. Ill will, the opposite of that is obviously metta, and the opposite of delusion is becoming wise by coming to classes such as this. And the roots, non-greed, non-hate, non-delusion. Non-greed is called renunciation, non-hate is called metta, loving-kindness, non-delusion is called wisdom. When a noble disciple has thus understood the unwholesome, its root, the wholesome, and the root of the wholesome, they entirely abandon the underlying tendency to lust. They abolish the underlying tendency to aversion. They extirpate the underlying tendency to the view and conceit I am. And by abandoning ignorance and arousing true knowledge, they here and now make an end of suffering. In that way, too, a noble disciple is one of right view, whose view is straight, who has perfect confidence in the Dhamma and has arrived in this true Dhamma. This paragraph is repeated with the change of the subject. Here it's the wholesome and the unwholesome. And they say, by understanding these things in depth, then you entirely abandon not just lust itself, but the underlying tendency to lust, to desire. Why do we desire? Why we extirpate or abandon the underlying tendency to aversion? Why is it that some things we just don't like? So it's not under abandoning the thing itself as much as under abandoning its causes again, the underlying tendency. And it tells you what the underlying tendency is by saying, extirpating the underlying tendency to the view and conceit, I am. It's all the idea of me and mine. And by extirpating, in other words, abandoning the underlying tendency to the view and conceit, I am, thereby you abandon ignorance and arousing true knowledge, and there you end suffering. So by abandoning the delusion of me and mine. Yeah. Number 8. Okay, let's keep going, because it starts on something reasonably ordinary, but it gets into deeper territory, even in the next section, nutriment. Nutriment is another word for food. It means what sustains something. Just like food sustains you, there are these nutriments which sustain the effects, karmic causes, which are the nutriment to certain effects. You might even say here that, you know, what's the nutriment of aversion, of ill will? And I would usually say it's a frustrated will. What's the nutriment of desire? Sometimes it might be sort of attention on the wrong things, not seeing the whole thing. You go to the shop, you just see the object, you don't see the price, and you don't see your bank account. And if you don't know your bank account and you don't know the price, then that can be a cause for unfettered greed. But here, what is the nutriment here? What does it mean? The monk said, good friends. The monks delighted and rejoiced in the Venerable Sariputta's words. Then they asked him a further question. But friend, might there be another way in which a noble disciple is one of right view and has arrived at this true Dhamma? There might be, friends. When, friends, a noble disciple understands nutriment, the origin of nutriment, the cessation of nutriment, and the way leading to the cessation of nutriment, in that way he is one of right view and has arrived at this true Dhamma. You notice again you have the same framework here. It's nutriment, its origin, cessation, and the way leading to its cessation, just like in the Four Noble Truths, which are going to come next. And what is nutriment? What is its origin, cessation, and the way leading to the cessation of nutriment? There are four kinds of nutriment for the maintenance of beings that have already come to be and for the support of those seeking a new existence. There's a new translation of that word which seems to be about to come to be. But certainly it's talking about beings who are not yet born. So here we have very clearly saying that we're not just talking about human beings, but beings in other planes who are seeking to be reborn. What are these four nutriments for the maintenance and for the support of those coming to a new existence? They are, one, physical food as nutriment, gross or subtle, contact as the second, mental volition as the third, and consciousness as the fourth. With the arising of craving, there is the arising of nutriment. Craving is causing this nutriment. Cessation of craving, there's a cessation of nutriment, and the way leading to the cessation of the nutriment is just this Noble Eightfold Path. That is right view, right intention, speech, action, livelihood, effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration, or jhana. Okay, the standard Eightfold Path. But let's go back here. The four kinds of nutriments to keep beings going. First of all, there's the physical food. When they say the gross and subtle, the subtle food here will be referring to the food which keeps beings who are about to come to be or seeking a new existence. It's so fascinating that in the Buddhist tradition that sometimes if there is like a being, a Buddha or a ghost in a lower realm, sometimes one leaves food out for them. And according to the old tradition, just the sight of that food or the smell of it is enough to satisfy them. That's what it says for some Buddhas. So this is almost like a nutriment for them, which is why the, you know, in many traditions people actually do leave food out for their ancestors who are no longer with us. I've seen that very often in Thailand. It's a very useful, at least it used to be useful in the early days when I was a monk, because that's the only way the dogs would survive. Otherwise the dogs would get nothing to eat. But certainly, it does seem to be there is a subtle nutriment here. But it's quite obvious we do need physical food as a nutriment. Now the next two, the next three are very important. Contact means a sensual experience is a nutriment. So actually we do need sort of sensory input, sensory experience, actually to keep going. It's a nutriment which supports beings who are already alive and which also supports beings seeking a new existence, as does mental volition, will, and lastly, consciousness, which is tied in with contact here. In other words, to keep a human being going, it's not just physical food, as everyone knows. It also needs a sensory experience, which means if someone is in a coma and they do not get any sensory experience at all, that particular food source or nutriment source is cut off, which is why it's standard procedure if someone's in a coma for you to talk to them, to hold their hand, to stroke them, to stimulate them, to give them enough contact, because that is an important support for their life. If you don't even touch them, don't talk to them, there's no sensory contact, then that particular nutriment keeping them alive will disappear. Which is why if a person is both deaf and blind, that unless they have some sensory contact, their human life cannot be supported. Obviously, will is an important thing to do, important support for the life of a human being. If a person hasn't got the will to live, it's very easy for a person just to give up that will to live. Happens in, say, indigenous communities, whether it's pointing the bone or whatever else. If you give up your will to live, if will disappears again, then one of the important supports for life disappears. And lastly, just like with contact, with sensory experience, consciousness is an important support, a nutriment which keeps one going. So here is the cause. Why do human beings keep alive? It's not just food, it's also these other three. Physical contact, the experiences of you which you have of life, your will, and your consciousness. Yes? Touch will have to be important, but none of whether that's enough, give enough sensory input. Fascinating. I'm not quite sure if there has been people who have been born deaf and blind, whether they survive. You know, it's obviously people who are born profoundly deaf, people who are blind. But has anyone ever heard of anyone who's been both deaf and blind? Yeah. She was deaf and blind, was she? Okay. How did she feel the world? Was it with touch? Yeah. Okay, by feeling, so she developed her sense of touch. But if you didn't have the sense of touch, then would you survive? It's one of the things that what it points out to is the body, the five senses are not here to support the body, but it's the body is there to support the five senses. It's the five sense world which is the important thing. So as long as your body can support the five senses, it will keep going. But the five senses are the main reason for living. To see, to hear, to smell, to taste, to touch. That's why we have a body. To facilitate the five senses experiencing the world. Because the other thing, people say the five senses are there. It's almost like a biological argument. The five senses are just there to support your physical body. But I really think it's the other way around. Does that make sense? Okay. And obviously willpower is important, just conscious experience is important. And here we go, what's the next part here? Okay, with the arising of craving, there's the arising of nutriment. That's certainly the case for physical food. As soon as you start craving, then you start cooking. Or at least you go to the shops and or call out for a pizza. So it's very quite clear that from craving there's the arising of the pizza. Physical food. But not only that, it's the craving. This obviously is the cause for the other nutriments as well. For contact, because of craving, we go out searching the world for things to satisfy us. And craving, it's interesting here, craving is also the cause of will and also consciousness. So why are we conscious? Because we want to. And our craving is almost like a part of will. Because we will, we keep on willing. Craving being a cause of will. I often mention this. I think I even mentioned it. This was in New Zealand. What is the cause of will? If it's not coming from a self, all your choices, all your intentions, all your willing, where does it come from? If it doesn't come from a self. And here he's saying one of the nutriments which keeps it going is craving. Just this underlying wanting, never being satisfied, always wanting something more. And that drives this whole process of will. When there's an end of craving, contentment, satisfaction, then there's no reason to will anymore. So all that willing disappears. So what's the cause of all that thinking which happens in your meditation? It is the will which comes from craving, from discontent. Because you're discontent, therefore you think. And it says it here, with the cessation of the nutriment. Sorry, with the cessation of craving, there's a cessation of the nutriments. When you stop all this craving business, and you're just content, this is good enough, this is good enough, this is good enough. And with that comes the cessation of these nutriments. Things like contact ceases. Which is why the five senses start to turn off. In meditation, once you start to build up contentment. Which is why will turns off when you start to develop contentment in your meditation. You're happy being here. So you're not willing to be anywhere else. There's nothing disturbing the mind. Therefore it becomes still. And eventually, because you're not craving for anything, consciousness also disappears. This is the cessation of the contact, the five senses, will in second jhana, and consciousness as one goes through the immaterial attainments. Things cease. Yes, Rodney. Aha. Well, the difference here is the craving is no longer there, but the result of the craving is still there. These senses are called old karma, the karma from previous to his enlightenment, which is why, as it says, one of my favorite sayings, it's from the Theragata, mentioned by many enlightened monks and nuns, who said that being an arahat is like a workman waiting for their wages. They finish the job, but the check's in the mail. In other words, that they've eradicated the craving. This is the craving for being the big cravings. But they haven't got the result yet, which is the happens at their parinibbana, at the end of their lifespan. The causes have all been abandoned. But now they're just living on the karma from their past. The very fact the craving which caused them birth into this life, their life is still, from that time on, is caused from their past. So that's why they are still existing. They've cut off the cause, but it takes a while for that to work out, and at the end of their life, that's when they get their wages. They've done their job. When you go to work, when you finish your work, you don't get your payment straight away. And there's always a delay. That's where the government makes its money. And in that delay period, that's the life of the enlightened being. That desire, that's not coming from the craving. They have the craving for sensory desire, the craving for existence, and the craving for annihilation. Those are the cravings there. These are the what motivates the enlightened being is a different thing from craving. We usually call it the four brahmaviharas. And it's usually developed because of being of service to other beings. So unless there's some reason, and it comes to externally, not what I want, not what I need, not a craving coming from an I, but a craving coming from the sense of service, loving kindness, then the arahat, the enlightened being, cannot survive. There is a point of Dhamma, which you probably heard before. If a lay person becomes fully enlightened, an arahat, then according to the traditional wisdom in the commentaries, that they cannot survive unless they become a monk or a nun. So if you get enlightened this afternoon, if you don't come and join the monastery and ordain, then they say you've only got at most 7 days. You must die. And say, why is that? It's because there's nothing to keep you going. The craving has been destroyed unless you can be of real service to the world. And they say at least being a member of the Sangha, you're a field of merit to the world, even if you can't teach. Therefore that being in the Sangha can keep you going. The loving kindness, the compassion, the service, which is inherent in that lifestyle, is sufficient to keep your life continuing until the end of your lifespan. But alternatively, that if you know you're a lay person and you cut off craving, what? There's no more nutriment left to keep you going. There's no more will, no more contact or consciousness, and especially the will, the craving is just not there anymore. That's why an enlightened being, if they're not a monk or a nun, will just disappear. How's that? It answers that question, which sometimes one of those questions that people always they read in some of the commentaries, and they actually ask, you know, why? And this is an answer which is here. Why an enlightened person, if they're a lay person, has to die? Because the nutriments have been cut off. They need some other nutriment to keep on going. Is that okay for now? It has to be. No, it has to be something which is real service. But just like helping out in the garden or with the washing up, it's not sort of powerful enough motivation. it's hardly enough to motivate yourself to wash up anyway. But, you know, it has to be something really sort of powerful service to enlighten other beings, rather than just to even like be a nurse or a doctor is not sufficient. It has to be in the cause of enlightenment, nothing less. Okay, yes? Yes. It was karmic. So these things happen for karma. Sure, yeah. It's what happens. Okay, and again at the very end here, paragraph 12, when a noble disciple has thus understood nutriment, its origin, its cessation, the way leading to the cessation of nutriment, understand what this nutriment is and how it keeps this human body going, then you can entirely abandon the underlying tendency to greed, abolish the underlying tendency to aversion, extirpate the underlying tendency to the view and conceit I am. When you know this life is caused, you know what the causes are, then you realize that this is not me, it doesn't belong to me, I am not this body, even this mind. You can see just how craving keeps this mind consciousness going, keeps will going. And thereby you can abandon ignorance and arouse true knowledge, and here and now make the end of suffering. In that way too, a noble disciple is one of right view, whose view is straight, who has perfect confidence in the Dhamma and has arrived at this true Dhamma. So even here in this one, the Svenasaya Purita is showing that this is the essence of what we call a human being, or someone seeking existence, is to see how these nutriments keeps it going. The nutriments, you know, being just not just physical food, but contact, will, and consciousness, and how these come about through craving. So you understand what will is, and so you're not sort of so attached to your personal choice. You know what consciousness is, you know its causes, you're not so attached to it. It's not you, not me, not mine. Therefore, you can let it go. When you let it go, it goes, and that's the end of suffering. The Four Noble Truths. Saying, good friend, the monks delighted and rejoiced in the Venerable Sariputta's words. They asked him a further question. Might there be another way? There might be friends. When a friend, a noble disciple, understands dukkha, the origin of dukkha, the cessation of dukkha, and the way leading to the cessation of dukkha, in that way they're one of right view. One has arrived at this true Dhamma, standard Four Noble Truths. And this is also one of the definitions of right view, which is used elsewhere very often. Someone who understands the Four Noble Truths is someone who is of right view. In fact, I haven't mentioned yet, but being someone of right view is a synonym, it's the same way of saying you're a stream winner or a soul one. Soul one is the Sri Lankan word. So I often ask people, do you understand the Four Noble Truths? And they can recite those Four Noble Truths, but are they a stream winner? What is the difference here? Why is it that many people think they know the Four Noble Truths, but they're not stream winners? Let's see what it says. When, friends, a noble disciple understands suffering, the origin of suffering, or sorry, the cessation of suffering, the way leading cessation of suffering, they have arrived at this true Dhamma. And what is suffering? What is its origin, cessation, and the way leading to the cessation of suffering? They say birth is suffering. Don't say like attachment to birth is suffering, just being born is suffering. So when people come and complain to me about their husband, their wife, their kids, their cancer, their job, their irritable guts, you say, what are you talking about? Why are you complaining? So birth is suffering. What do you expect, for goodness sake? You've got a human body. You're going to have suffering. The world is not going to be all roses. Life is not a bowl of cherries. It's a bowl of lemons. Rotten ones. But anyway, so birth is suffering. As soon as you take a human birth, you get a lot of your pleasure. Well, first few years is a bit tough. Once you finish school, then you get your pleasurable times. And then, you know, well, sort of anyway. And then you have to pay for it for the rest of your life. As you get older and things don't go well. So that is an incredibly powerful statement. the fact that birth is suffering. Because what it means is you're stuffed already. We've all been born. There's nothing much we can do. We can make the best out of this. But never think that once you're born that you can have some sort of real fulfillment, happiness, or whatever. You can get sort of partial happiness, but it's never good enough. Never will be good enough, having been born. So the goal becomes not trying to make something out of this life as much as making sure you don't get reborn again. So the goal of Buddhism becomes the ending of birth, not the fixing up of the problem. So birth is suffering, aging is suffering, as you all know, sickness is suffering, death is suffering. Sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief and despair are suffering. Not to attain what one wants is suffering. And of course, that happens every other time. If you get what you want, you don't get it long enough. A lot of time you get what you don't want. So this is called suffering. And in short, or rather not in short, in summary should be the word, the five aggregates affected by clinging are suffering. This is called suffering. The five aggregates are your body. Is your feelings, pleasure and pain, is suffering. Pleasure is suffering because it doesn't last. And pain is suffering because it's inherently unpleasant. And perception is suffering. You never see the full picture sometimes. You always perception, too often when we are subject to the desire and ill will, our perception is bent to suit us. And will is suffering. The karma formations, the sankharas, is suffering. To have to make a choice. That's why that suffering of modern life, going to a supermarket, where there's so many different types of muesli. It was easy when I was a young vegetarian. There's only one muesli, and you had to go to a special shop to get it. In the supermarkets, you will never find it. Now you have so many different brands. The choice is just so much suffering. Will is suffering. And consciousness is suffering. Now that's a big one. To realize, to be, is to suffer. That consciousness itself is inherently suffering. As I mentioned many times, the only way you can understand that is to see consciousness disappear. And see once it's disappeared, oh, this seems so nice. A person born in a jail, lived all their life in a jail, can't understand what prison is. But when they leave prison for the first time and they go out into the free world, oh, this is so wonderful. And a person lets go of consciousness for the first time. They escape from consciousness. Then they realize that consciousness is suffering. So what the Buddha says, right here, yes. Yeah, will causes consciousness, consciousness causes will. The two go around each other. If you let go of one of them, the other one disappears. But it's will disappears first, and consciousness disappears next. Sure. The doing is like the willing. Consciousness is the being. The will comes first, then consciousness. But consciousness also reinforces the willing. Yeah. And it stops first. Because when it stops, consciousness has to stop. You are because you want to be. Wanting comes first. Okay, that's then. What's the origin of suffering? This is called suffering. Or dukkha. What's the origin? What's the cause of suffering here? Again, it's this craving business, but not any old craving here, which partially answers Rodney's early question. What is the origin of suffering? It's craving. It's particular craving, three types of craving, but it's a craving that brings renewal of being, or in other words, reincarnation or rebirth. It's a Pali word, ponobhavika, for rebirth. It's a craving which causes rebirth, which is accompanied by delight and lust. And say delights in this and that. The usual translation is finding pleasure here and there. It's that craving which looks for pleasure, enjoyment, here, there, all over the place. And in particular, that is the three types of craving. Craving for sensory pleasures, and that's the pleasures of the five senses, always to do with sense the pleasure in the realm of sight, sound, smells, tastes, and touches. And craving for being, and also the craving to annihilate a being, craving for non-being. This is called the origin of suffering. So it's those particular types of craving, which answers the question that when an arahat is certainly has desires, but these aren't desires which causes renewal of being. They still cause suffering, but they don't cause the renewal of being. The cravings of an arahat still cause suffering. Yeah. Craving for annihilation is assumes that there is something to annihilate, which is, that's the delusion. This is the suicidal tendencies of a human being. You think that I am, you don't like it, so you want to annihilate it. And as the Buddha said very lovely, he said it's like a dog chasing its tail, or literally tied around a post chasing itself. Or as I remember reading Oliver Twist when I was a kid, and one of the, I forget who it was, one of the people in the, one of the characters there, would always say this is impossible, if this really happens, I'll eat my own head. And the idea to eat your own head is a very interesting thing to contemplate. And how could you do that? It's obviously impossible to eat your own head. But when you understand what the craving of annihilation is, it is literally trying to eat your own head. How can you annihilate yourself? I have to annihilate me. So you just can't, the I can't annihilate an I. Just the same way you can't eat your own head. That's why it's a craving based on delusion. No, I don't think so, because that's not what motivates you with your partner. That is usually the motivation for sensory pleasures. The craving for annihilation. But that, but it's, there's another word for annihilation, is a very aggressive, violent thing to do. There's another word for, instead of annihilation, which is very often used in Buddhism, called cessation, which is allowing things to cease according to their nature, rather than you being the agent of their cessation. So it's when there's a me involved in there, that I am the one who is going to create this merging with God. When there's a self involved there, it can never work. It's just like the person who tries to merge with God. They have to get out of the way, first of all, to be able to even get close to that concept. Which is why the path to merging with a God in the Christian mystic and the Indian mystic traditions is always surrender. So they surrender to the process rather than they are the one who's actualizing it. So this is actually the difference between the annihilation, because it's a thing which I'm doing, and just the process of cessation, when you get out of the way first. Okay, and what is the cessation of suffering? It is the remainderless fading away and ceasing, the giving up, relinquishing, letting go and rejecting of that same craving. In other words, the relinquishing, letting go, rejecting and ceasing of the craving for sensory pleasures, the craving for being, or the craving for annihilation. That is the cessation of suffering. So in other words, one gives up the search for fulfillment, for pleasure, for ease in the realm of the five senses. One gives up the craving to be, and also one gives up the craving for annihilating oneself. for that is the ending of suffering. And you can also go into great detail here, the four ways of letting go here. Relinquishing, this means throwing away. The letting go, which is, what is it? The giving up, first of all. That's patinissaga muti. Relinquishing is freedom. What's the other one? Patinissaga muti and nalio. Oh, I forgot it now. But these are like the four ways of letting go. That's right. It's giving. It's what's that called? It's chaga. Chaga was the one I was looking at. That's the first one. These are four ways of letting go. The first is chaga, means giving, expecting nothing back in return. That's chaga, the way of letting go. So there's no self. You just abandon things. Patinissaga is when you throw things away. Analia is what I sometimes call the Teflon mind, and muti, freedom. In other words, being content. This is good enough. Maybe later on. And these are the rejecting that same type of craving, is the cessation of suffering. And what is the way leading to the cessation of suffering? It is a Noble Eightfold Path, as is the way to the ending of all of these things. The right view, intention, speech, action, livelihood, effort, mindfulness, and right concentration, or samadhi. So, any questions about the Four Noble Truths there? Which means you're all stream winners now? Sorry? Yeah. Freedom, yeah. The story which I give, you know, about people being in prison, difference between being in prison and being in our monastery. Monastery is more austere than any prison in Western Australia, but people love to go to the monastery and stay there. Why? Why do they always want to escape from jail? A prison is any place you don't want to be. Freedom is any place you want to be. In other words, no, you abandon choice. So you're just happy to be here. You're not sort of that choice, that will, which wants to be somewhere else. This is good enough. Which is an abandoning of will. Abandoning of the craving. Contentment. Now the fourth one is usually, I call it the Teflon mind, analia. Nothing sticks to you. But that's the whole, I've given whole talks on that. I can go on for an hour on this, and I don't want to go on too long today. And there's lots more to go yet to focus on. So when a noble disciple has thus understood suffering, or the Four Noble Truths, in that way too, they're one of right view, one has arrived at this true Dhamma. They say they can entirely abandon the underlying tendency to greed, aversion, and the conceit, I am. They abandon ignorance and arouse true knowledge. They here and now make an end of suffering. And they said that was one of the ways of Buddha gained his enlightenment, through understanding just these Four Noble Truths. And when the Buddha talked about this in the Dhammacakka Sutta, he said that he understood these things fully. And that's the main reason why people aren't stream winners. Because there's some part of suffering we just do not see. We have our blind spots. We think there's somewhere, some part of consciousness or will, where we can have a good time. Some little heaven realm, some aspect of existence, where we can hang up our hat and exist without suffering. And if you think there is some little corner of samsara just for you, where you can exist forever and ever, then you haven't fully understood the Four Noble Truths. Sorry? Yeah. Then you have to join the Sangha. Yeah. How is the body still suffering? Because you've ended the cause of suffering. And the suffering will end at your parinibbana. Your body still suffers. That's why they call a person who's an arahat, they got fully enlightened, they call it enlightenment with something remaining, which is your body and your mind. But at parinibbana, when you pass away, then it's aparisesa nibbana. Nibbana with nothing remaining whatsoever. So the task, you've done your job, but you haven't got your wages yet, if you're enlightened and still talking. Now, aging and death. Now here we get into the beginning of the dependent origination. Saying good friend, is there another way you can say right view? I'm abbreviating here. When friends, a noble disciple understands aging and death, the origin of aging and death, the cessation of aging and death, and the way leading to the cessation of aging and death, in that way you'll run a right view, has arrived at this true Dhamma. So this is how to stop aging and death. This is the answer to how to stop aging, the Buddhist answer to end aging and to stop people dying. The holy grail of medicine. And what is aging and death? What's its origin? How does it end? What's the way leading to the cessation of aging and death? So, aging of beings in the various orders of beings, their old age, brokenness of teeth, greyness of hair, wrinkling of the skin, decline of light, weakness of faculties, this is called aging. In other words, it's not a metaphysical aging. This means aging as everybody understands it. The passing of beings out of the various orders of beings, their passing away, dissolution, disappearance, dying, completion of time, dissolution of the aggregates, just like you're reading a dictionary, this is called death. The Buddha is saying this because he wants to make it very clear, this is not some death in the moment or old age in the moment, this is death and old age as everybody realizes it to be. So the aging and this death are what is called aging and death. What is the cause of aging and death? With the arising of birth, there is the arising of aging and death. With the cessation of birth is the cessation of aging and death. And the way leading to the cessation of aging and death is just this Noble Eightfold Path. When a noble disciple has thus understood aging and death, its origin, its cessation, and the way leading to the cessation of aging and death, then they can abandon the underlying tendency to greed, aversion, and the conceit I am, and they can arise true knowledge, they're a noble disciple, one of right view, who's arrived at the true Dhamma. So, all the Botox in the world, all of the facelifts in the world, all of the chemicals you can possibly inject into your system will not stop aging and death. You can't have these, was it, cryogenic people get frozen in the United States for about 2,000 years, and when sort of science evolves, then they can actually be thawed out and live again. Of course that can't happen, because the only way to stop aging and death is stop being born. So the whole idea of like sort of being, having eternal life is, you know, said by the Buddha here to be a complete sort of waste of time. The only thing is, now you got born, you're going to get old, you're going to die. It's obvious. But how many people are in denial of that? And so, now birth. Say, if birth is the origin of aging and death, what is the origin of birth? Saying, good friends, the monks delight and rejoice in the Venerable Sai Buddha's words, but friend, might there be another way in which a noble disciple is one of right view? Yep. When, friends, a noble disciple understands birth, its origin, cessation, and the way leading to the cessation of birth, in that way they are one of right view. And what is birth, its origin, cessation, and way leading to the cessation of birth? The birth of beings in the various orders of beings. In the Mahanidana Sutta, they go into detail. They say birds into the state of being birds, quadrupeds into the state of being quadrupeds, ghosts in the state of being ghosts, monsters into the state of being monsters, human beings into the state of being human beings. In other words, it means birth as we ordinarily expect it. I mention this because some Buddhist commentators try and interpret dependent origination to mean some sort of birth in the moment. But the way the Buddha describes it here and also in the Mahanidana Sutta, it's very clear it means birth in the usual meaning of the term. It means birth, you know, when someone gives birth to a baby. That's what birth means. It doesn't mean the arising of something in the moment. So that's what birth is, the birth of the beings and the various orders of beings. They're coming to birth, participation in a womb, generation, manifestation of the aggregates, abstaining the basis for contact, the sense basis. This is called birth. Now, with the arising of being, there is the arising of birth. There's something here called bhava. It means existence, being. It's almost like existence is a cause for birth. With the cessation of existence or being, there's a cessation of birth. And the way leading to the cessation of birth is just this Noble Eightfold Path. Again, so if you want to stop being born, the Eightfold Path is the way to stop being born. When you understand what this birth is, its origin, cessation, the way leading to the cessation of birth, you can now make an end of suffering. So this is actually the idea of like being, this thing called bhava. Now exactly what is this bhava, we'll find out next. Monks delight and rejoice in the Venerable Sariputta's words. Is there another way in which you can describe right view? Yes. When a friend, a noble disciple, understands this word being, its origin, cessation, the way leading to the cessation, and that they are one of right view. So what actually is existence, bhava? And what is being, its origin, cessation, the way leading to the cessation of being? There are these three kinds of being. Sense sphere being, fine material being, and immaterial being. The sense sphere being, this is the world of the karma loka, which includes the hell realms, the ghost realms, the animal realms, and the lower deva realms, as well as the human realm. You're talking here about the planes of existence. To understand existence, life, if you like, it's not just human life, to see the whole extent of the animal life. Not only they call it the animal kingdom. Maybe you should call it animal democracy or animal anarchy. I don't know why they call it animal kingdom. But we also have the ghost realms and the deva realms as well. And then we've got these other two realms, the fine material realm, which is the realm of the jhanas, and the immaterial realm is the realm of the immaterial jhanas. So this is a huge area which many people haven't discovered. This is what existence means, beings, planes of existence. In the suttas, they also use the word very often like manasabhava, which means almost like a sub-realm of the human existence. So what existence is like levels of being into which you can get reborn into. So the idea of bhava, or existence, is almost like a level of existence, a plane of existence, a form in which you can take birth into. And then you understand why you need the plane of existence in order to be reborn into it. Why that, in this sense, is a cause of birth. Before you can be born, you need somewhere to be born into, basically. That's the meaning of bhava, existence. Plant beings, the Buddha says that is almost like a place where it can supply a process of consciousness arising from those plants. So this is very not clear at all in the suttas, in the Buddha's words, but there is two suttas, actually the same sutta, but it's repeated in two different places, where the only place where it does suggest that plants have not the full five khandhas, they haven't got self-consciousness, says the Buddha, but they can develop and evolve into, say, the animal realm. And as any biologist knows, that there are some plants which are very hard to say whether they are plants or the very lower form of animals. So the Buddha mentioned that as if the streams of consciousness can evolve from the plant form. So it's not like a realm of existence, but a way you can actually enter these realms of existence. Yeah. But no, I don't think it's that. The Buddha actually saw that they can sort of evolve. That's why even being a vegetarian is a bit sus these days when you understand Buddhism. Anyway, I won't go into that one. Okay, and so that's what this being is. Now, what is the cause of this being? So with the arising of clinging, or this is attachments, otherwise known as like fuel. This is upadana. And of all the translations of that word, upadana literally means a taking up. That's its root meaning. Upa is the same as our English word up, and adana means taking, like adinadana, not taking what's not given. So this is the cause of existence, or the planes of existence. It's a taking up, it's a fuel which causes these things. So just like a fuel creates flame, so there's this fuel creates existence. We find out what exactly this fuel is afterwards. And oh, gone over here. Oops, sorry, just see. Wind blew it over. Here we go. So upadana, clinging, it says here, otherwise known as fuel. With the arising of fuel, there's the arising of this existence. With the cessation of the fuel, there's the cessation of the existence. And the way leading to the cessation of being or existence is the Noble Eightfold Path. When a noble disciple understands this, they can abandon the underlying tendencies too. Greed, aversion, and get rid of the sense I am. We know what existence actually is. It's nothing to do with you. Now we've got clinging, otherwise known as fuel. Saying, good friends, amongst the light and rejoicing of Venerable Sariputta's words, they ask him a further question. Is there another way to explain right view? Yes. When, friends, a noble disciple understands clinging or upadana, the origin, the cessation, and the way leading to the cessation of this fuel, this clinging, in that way they are also one of right view, one who has arrived at this true Dhamma. And what is upadana, clinging, its origin, cessation, and the way leading to the cessation of clinging? There are these four types of clinging, or four types of fuel. I'm going to call it fuel here. When you read it, they've got clinging. The fuel of the sensory pleasures, the fuel of views, the fuel of rules and observances, and the fuel of a doctrine of self. Now you can understand when I call it fuel that these are the things, because they were fuel, these ideas or tendencies are what creates existence. Before, I've mentioned in quite a few of the talks over the past year about the creator of the universe. And this is, I was using this to answer the debate or give the Buddhist idea on the debate of intelligent design. Who creates this physical universe? And I'm saying here, what creates being, existence, is this fuel which eventually comes from craving. We create it. The sensory desire. The views, the rules and observances, the doctrine of a self, this is the whole process which creates our world. Coming earlier from craving. So what is this fuel? Its origin, cessation, away leading to cessation. The four kinds of fuel or clinging to sensory pleasures, to view, rules and observances, and a doctrine of a self. The rules and observances one is later defined as where the rules and observances are considered to be that important, especially the idea that they're going to create liberation if you just do some initiation or ceremony thinking that's sufficient, where it's useful but it's not obviously sufficient to get out of samsara, but also that the rules and observances create our worlds. The idea of a self creates our worlds. The sensory pleasures creates our world. Our views create our world. Creating existence. And the levels of existence. With the arising of craving, there is the arising of this fuel which creates the world. In other words, it's craving which causes the sensory pleasure fuel, the view fuel. Craving creates our views. Our view is what we want to believe. We will not accept what we don't want to believe. And it's the craving creates a doctrine of a self. I am because I want to be. So the arising of craving, there's the arising of clinging. With the cessation of craving, there's the cessation of this fuel. And the way leading to the cessation of this fuel is this Noble Eightfold Path. When a noble disciple does understand clinging, its origin, cessation, or way leading to the cessation of clinging, they have abandoned the underlying tendencies to greed, aversion, and the underlying tendency to the conceit I am. They've made an end of suffering. So this is how existence is being created. Any questions so far on this? Yeah. Example in Buddhism is that if you, for example, think that just doing a particular chant again and again and again and again is enough to make you enlightened. That's like an observance, like a rule which you think is enough to overcome your clinging. Or, you know, if you think that you go to some sort of initiation ceremony over 3 or 4 days and think that, you know, somehow something's happened inside of me which makes me even more enlightened. Or if you think that just because you keep precepts, that's good enough. So, but you can see like the rules and observances. So, if, you know, for example, just how the rules and rituals of the Islamic world, you know, create a culture, create a world. So it's much easier to see how these things are created outside of your own sphere. But then when you apply it to your own sphere, you can just see how your rules and observances create your very existence. Now we have Victorian England, and why we call it Victorian England? Because of that, the rules and observances which were common at that time. It's the rules and observances which create the culture. You know, we may have like a footy rule and observance, or a sport, which creates our culture, creates Australia as we can recognize it. So remember, this is the creating of existence, the cause for the creating of existence, of the worlds, of the societies in which we live. And we're born into that society. Yeah, indeed, yeah. They're not inherently bad, but it's just how they're used. We can see how they create. The vinaya creates this world of the Sangha. So it's not inherently bad, but there's much more to it than that. But here we're seeing how things are created. And how birth happens. Okay, so craving. Can there be another way you can describe right view? You can, when a noble disciple understands craving, the origin, cessation, or way leading to the cessation of craving, and that way they're one of right view. Craving is this word tanha. I didn't actually mention upadana as well as being fuel and clinging. It's also the word for attachment. And that is a word which is used so often in Western Buddhism without people really understanding what its meaning is, and again to all sorts of confusions about what attachment is. And you say, yeah, you're attached to your 5 precepts, you should let go. And completely misunderstanding what the word means. So it's not just attachment, it's just like the idea of a fuel which creates something. But so we go back to craving. What is craving? What's its origin? Cessation or leading to cessation of craving. Here it just says there are 6 types of craving. Craving for forms with the eye, for sounds, for odors, for flavors, for tangibles, and for mind objects. So it's describing craving by where it appears or what it desires in the realm of the 6 senses. I should mention in the Dhammacakka Sutta, the Buddha gives another definition of craving, the types of craving as karma dhanha, bhava dhanha, and again vibhava dhanha, the same types of craving as we had in the 4 Noble Truths. If you go back to the 4 Noble Truths, they say on paragraph 16, what is the origin of suffering? It is a craving, especially the craving for being, for non-being, for sensory pleasures, as we discussed earlier. But it's those 3 types of craving now manifest with the objects of the 6 senses. So we have like the craving, that type of craving creates the fuel which makes existence so we can get reborn into those existences. In another simile which the Buddha gave, he gave a simile of like a field being the karma, process, what is it called, the stream of consciousness being the seed, craving being the moisture, and this is, he said, the process of existence, with craving and with the soil of karma, then beings can actually get reborn into these states of existence. It's the craving and the karmic wherewithal are necessary ingredients to create the existence where you take rebirth. So here the craving, the six types of craving. What's the cessation of craving? What's the cause of the craving? With the arising of feeling, there's the feeling, the pleasure and the pain, or the beauty and the ugliness, the sense of pleasure or displeasure with each of the six senses, there is the arising of craving. With the cessation of this sensory experience called feeling, there is a cessation of craving. The way leading to the cessation of craving is just this Noble Eightfold Path. When a noble disciple has understood craving, its origin, cessation, way leading to cessation, they now, here and now, make an end of suffering. They abandon the underlying tendencies to greed, hatred, to greed, aversion, and conceit, I am. I'll just go on to feeling, then we'll pause for some more discussion if there is some. What actually is this feeling, which is the cause of this craving business? Is there another way you can describe right views? Disciples ask, yes, said Sariputta. When, friends, a noble disciple understands feeling, this Vedana, its origin, cessation, away leading to cessation of a sensory experience called feeling, then they're one of right view. And what is this feeling? What's its origin, its cessation, away leading to its cessation? There are these six classes of feeling: feeling born of eye contact, feeling born of ear contact, nose contact, tongue contact, body contact, and mind contact. In other words, the six senses. And each one of these six senses, the experience can be pleasant, middling, or unpleasant. And the quality of being pleasant or unpleasant or in between is what we mean by feeling. And you can see that how that is a cause for craving. When we have a pleasurable experience, we want more of it. When we have an unpleasant experience, we want to get rid of it. And with the arising of contact, which is the first part of sensory experience, when the eye and an object of the eye come together, it's called contact. So with the arising of contact, there's the arising of this feeling. The cessation of contact, there's the cessation of feeling. The way leading to the cessation of feeling is just this Noble Eightfold Path. The noble disciples thus understood as before. So here we're having like feeling, sensory experience being a cause of craving. Is it always a cause of craving? Obviously not, because enlightened ones, they certainly have feelings, they experience pleasure and pain, but they don't allow that to give rise to craving. To be accurate, you need two things here for the arising of craving. It's not just feeling, it's feeling and also delusion as well. If you have those two together, then craving will come. Yes, the jhanas are certainly consciousness. Jhanas have feeling, very pleasurable feeling, no delusion during that time. That's why in the jhanas there's no possibility of making any bad karma. Yeah, but during the experience of jhana there's a lot of pleasure, a lot of mindfulness, but that's actually not part of the discussion here, so we'll just come back into here. Hey, mind consciousness, yes. Mind consciousness is there with every other type of consciousness. Whatever you hear, the mind knows you heard it. That's mind consciousness as well. Okay, no trouble. No, it's okay, no trouble. Okay. To contact. Okay, to contact. So in good friends, amongst the light of rejoicing of Venerable Sariputta's words, might there be another way, there might be friends. When a friend's a noble disciple understands contact, it's the origin, the cessation, the way leading to cessation of contact, they are also one of right view. What is contact? Its origin, its cessation, the way leading to its cessation. Again, there are six classes of contact, according to the six senses, eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and mind contact. Now, what that actually means is, again, the whole sensory experience here, what we call like life, you know, what is our life? It's just actually how we experience it through our six senses. Understanding to have an sensory experience with its correlated pleasure, pain, or in-between. Now, obviously, we have to have a functioning eye. It has to see something. If you turn out all the lights, obviously, the eye consciousness will turn off itself. It needs to have an object to have a audio experience. You have to be able to hear something. You have, the body has to feel something. The mind has to know something. So you have like this object coming together with the sensory base, as they call it. And when those two come together, then consciousness is turned on. The whole thing is like this contact. The whole thing has been stimulated into existence. That's what this contact really means. And with the arising of the sixfold base, you don't need just the object, you need the sensory apparatus. You need an eye, you need a functioning ear, you need a body, a nose or a tongue or a mind to be able to have this sensory experience called contact. Which is why they say the sixfold sense base. When that arises, then is arising of contact. With the cessation of sixfold base, is a cessation of contact. The way into the cessation of sensory experience is just this noble eightfold path. I'll pause there because hear what the Buddha's actually saying, he or Sariputta's saying, that the eightfold path, it means it's stopping sensory experience, stopping contact and the feeling which comes from that contact. No, it's stopping it, leading to its cessation, leading to cessation of sensory experience. Not just seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, but also knowing as well, mind consciousness. That's why I pointed that out. It's very clear. You read it again for yourself. With the way into the cessation of contact, cessation of all feeling. You soon have the cessation of the sixfold sense base, the eightfold path. So there can never be, through the practice of the eightfold path, you're basically turning off the sensory experience. And with the cessation of the sixfold sense base, there's the cessation of contact. The way leading to the cessation of contact, the noble eightfold path. When noble disciples thus understood contact, its origin, cessation, the way leading to the cessation of contact, they can abandon the underlying tendencies to greed, to aversion, and the idea I am. Because you think we are the sensory world. When you can allow this sensory world to cease, then you are not anymore. The sixfold sense base. Saying, good friends, amongst delight and rejoicing in the Venerable Sariputta's words, they asked him, is there another way to explain right view? When, friends, a noble disciple understands the sixfold sense base, its origin, cessation, the way it into its cessation, and that way they are one of right view. What is the sixfold base? Its origin, cessation, the way it into its cessation. There are these six sense bases, the eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and mind base. So these are the six senses. How do they come about? They say with the arising of mentality, materiality, nama rupa, there is the arising of the six senses. With the cessation of nama rupa, mentality, materiality, is the cessation of the six sense base. The way leading to the cessation of the sixfold base is just this noble eightfold path. When a noble disciple has thus understood the sixfold base, its origin, cessation, the way leading to its cessation, they hereby abandon the underlying tendency to desire, to greed, to aversion, and to the idea I am, they make an end of suffering. I just go to Nama. Rupa, mentality, materiality. Good friend, amongst delight and rejoicing of Venerable Sai Buddha's words is another way you can describe right view. There might be friends. When friends, a noble disciple understands mentality, materiality, its origin, cessation, the way into its cessation, in that way they can be called one of right view. And what is this Nama Rupa, its origin, its cessation, the way into its cessation? This Nama Rupa is, and this is an important point, I'm going to pause here. Nama Rupa is like feeling, the pleasure and the pain, perception, volition, contact, and attention. These are called mentality. The four great elements and the material form derived from the four great elements, that's earth, air, fire, and water, these are called materiality. This mentality and this materiality is what's called mentality, materiality. So obviously the materiality is the stuff of the world, you know, the stuffness. And the other stuff, the mentality, you see the one thing which is missing there is consciousness. That's why a good way of describing this, and the way which I prefer to make it quite clear, is mentality, materiality is like the objects of consciousness. What consciousness can be aware of. If consciousness is like a screen, mentality, materiality are the objects on a screen. Now we get into a lot of arguments on this point because this was how mentality, materiality were understood in the time of the Buddha. When the Abhidharma and commentaries came into the scene, they actually included consciousness in mentality, materiality and confused the whole issue. But I always take my Buddhism from the time of the Buddha, and here consciousness is not mentioned at all. It's not part of mentality, materiality. And this is a little fine point, but it's an important point. And even to this day, we still have arguments. But this is what the Buddha said here. So have a look at this as the objects of consciousness. You can understand the objects of consciousness, and later on consciousness, this actually creates. It's almost another way of saying the arising of the sensory experience called the six senses. And with them, the contact and the feeling and the craving which comes from it. We're talking here about the process of the sensory experience. Okay, with the arising of consciousness, there comes the arising of mentality, materiality. If you can think of this mentality, materiality as the objects, obviously you need a screen before you have the images on the screen. You need the consciousness before you have the objects of consciousness. With the arising of consciousness is the arising of mentality, materiality. With the cessation of consciousness is the cessation of mentality, materiality. The way leading to the cessation of the objects of consciousness is just this Noble Eightfold Path. That is the right view, right concentration. And it is interesting here, just that Noble Eightfold Path, culminating in Sammasamadhi, the jhanas, this is actually what you experience when you go through those jhanas. That feeling, perception, volition, contact, and attention, they all, stage by stage, turn off. The feeling of the five senses turns off in the first jhana. The perception of that world turns off. The full perception of the world of mind turns off in the fourth immaterial attainment, the state of neither perception nor non-perception, actually it's turning off. And it fully turns off in the next stage of cessation. Volition finishes in second jhana. And the contact, the five sense world contact, obviously finishes in the first jhana. The sixth sense contact, again, finishes at the end of the immaterial attainments. And even attention, work of the mind. That's called manasikara, that work of the mind. And I prefer that rather than attention. It literally means manasi is of the mind, kara. It's actually the same root as karma. It's actually what we do. So again, I would even say in second jhana, work of the mind finishes. So this is actually how you can see that through the Eightfold Path, it actually allows this objects of consciousness to turn off. And for those of you who want to understand the immaterial attainments, the consciousness, the objects of consciousness is obviously a duality there. it's the objects turn off first of all. So consciousness is seeing nothing. It sees nothing first of all, and then the consciousness turns off. The objects finish first, and then the consciousness finishes afterwards. So this with the cessation of consciousness, it's the cessation of mentality, materiality. The way into the cessation of mentality, materiality is just this Noble Eightfold Path. When a noble disciple has thus understood this nama rupa, its origin, cessation, and way leading to cessation of suffering, they thereby can abandon the underlying tendency to greed, to aversion, and to the conceit I am. Obviously, that when you know these things aren't really there, they're not really mine, then obviously there'll be no greed for them, no aversion, pleasure or pain, it's just nature, that's all, nothing to do with me, not my business, so there's no aversion anymore. We're going pretty deep here. Any questions so far? Yeah. Wow, okay. Sorry, number 16. Origin suffering, yeah? Yeah. Aha, is there no craving to go to hell? I think there is. It's called guilt. It's one of those psychological truths. But why do people always sort of maybe get married to a sort of violent man every time? Why is it that they almost like psychologically seek to deny themselves happiness? And of course it's the guilt which human beings have. The guilt is what seeks for punishment, which doesn't allow happiness. And so when it comes to a person's death, if you've done something really terrible and gross and you don't know how to forgive yourself or make amends, you will send yourself to hell for that. And how many people even now, they've done some terrible crime and they spend their whole life trying to take drugs or alcohol to run away from it. They just literally can't face themselves, some of the things which they've done. If that hasn't happened now, there comes a time in their life and they think, my God, what have I done? And that's sort of that conscience, that guilt, can drive a person crazy. And it could also drive them to hell. They go to hell because they want to. They think that's where they belong. That's what they deserve. Yeah, it's a craving for punishment. And you can see people all throughout the world, they seek that. They think they need to somehow make amends and they seek for punishment. Through compassion, through forgiveness, which is another word for letting go. This is one of the reasons why a stream winner will never send themselves to hell. They have got enough understanding of non-self that the idea of punishing just doesn't make any sense to them. Who can they punish? Why are they punishing? So that's why the stream winner, they can never go to the lower realms. It doesn't mean they've got this sort of free from hell card. Like when I used to play Monopoly, I used to get out of jail for free card. It just means that there's some psychological inherent thing in their being which means they will never go to hell. Even Angulimala, even though he was a multiple killer, he could forgive himself and just drop it, let it go. That's how it works. Okay. Now, consciousness. Saying, good friends, amongst the light and rejoicing of Venerable Sai Buddha's words, is there a further way in which you can say right view? Yes. When friends, a noble disciple understands consciousness. The origin of consciousness, its cessation, the way into a cessation of consciousness, then you can say they've arrived at the true Dhamma, they have right view. What is consciousness, its origin, its cessation, and the way into a cessation? Again, here he says the six classes of consciousness. Eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and mind consciousness. It's an important point that consciousness isn't just some sort of knowing. There's six different types of consciousness. And the old saying that an indigenous Inuit, not Eskimos, they can see six different types of snow. I would only see one type of snow because that's all I know. But an ordinary person might just see one type of consciousness, but a meditator knows six types of consciousness, it says here. And actually you can discern the different types of consciousness. The reason why it all appears the same is with every one of the five external consciousnesses of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, that's immediately followed by a mind consciousness, a knowing. And that gives every type of consciousness a sense of sameness. When you see or when you hear, there's something that has in common. What has it in common, even when you taste something? What it has in common is you know you've seen something, you know you've tasted it, you know you've heard it. And that follows immediately after the sense consciousness, a mind consciousness. And that gives it the illusion of sameness. When you can actually separate out these six different types of consciousness, you can see that all that's happening is seeing mind, seeing mind, seeing mind, hearing mind, hearing mind, hearing mind, or smelling mind. There's a mind consciousness happens after each one of the five external senses. And even after a mind consciousness, sometimes another mind consciousness, you know something and then you know that you knew. And that gives the idea of self-identity. It's not that you know, you know that you knew. So those are the different types of consciousness. Where does consciousness come from? With the arising of formations, they're usually called the karma formations, the sankharas, there is the arising of consciousness. With the cessation of the karma formations, there is the cessation of consciousness. The way leading to the cessation of consciousness is the Noble Eightfold Path. So you practice the Noble Eightfold Path to make you unconscious. In other words, to allow consciousness to cease. I'll bring this all together in the end. When a noble disciple has thus understood consciousness, its origin, cessation, way leading to its cessation, they here and now make an end of suffering. Saying, good friends amongst the delighted and rejoiced in the Venerable Sariputta's words. There is another way you can talk about right view. Yes, there is. When friends, a noble disciple understands karma formations, sankharas, its origin, cessation, and the way leading to cessation of formations. In that way, they're one of right view. What are the karma formations and origin, cessation, way leading to cessation? Now, these three types of karma formations, the bodily karma formations, the verbal karma formation, the mental karma formations, what you do by body, speech, and mind. And that karma, as I mentioned earlier, it's actually the karma together with craving creates rebirth. And with it, the consciousness and the whole sensory process again. And what is the... with the arising of ignorance, what I call delusion, there's the arising of the karma formations. You have these acts of body, speech and mind because of stupidity, basically. Because of delusion. You know, you say because you feel you need to say it. You do because you think it needs to be done. It's all coming from a delusion of me and mine. Having to be something in the world. And so with the arising of delusion, there's the arising of the karma formations. With the cessation of delusion, there's the cessation of the karma formations. And the way leading to the cessation of karma formations is the Eightfold Path. And delusion, is there another way for right view? Yes, when a friend, an old disciple, understands delusion. Here called ignorance, but ignorance just means that if you just someone tells you, that's enough. It's like delusion rather than ignorance is a far better translation of the word atvijja. When friends, a noble disciple understands delusion, its origin, cessation, and the way leading to its cessation, in that way they are one of right view. Now, what is the cause of delusion? Here we get to the heart of it. What is delusion, its cause, its cessation, the way leading to its cessation? Not knowing about suffering, the origin of suffering, the cessation of suffering, and the way leading to cessation of suffering. This is called delusion. And again, you all know about suffering. and its origin, its cessation, waiting for cessation. I've just read it out to you. You can probably chant it, some of you, in Pali. But that's obviously knowing is not a very good translation. It's not really understanding to its core what suffering is, or what the cause of suffering is, the end of suffering. What can be an end of suffering? Not understanding just the end of all things, being completely beyond your perceptions of what's possible, consciousness ending, no more will left at all. What can that be like? So not knowing the end of suffering, not understanding Nibbana, not understanding the path, it's that, not that full penetration of the Four Noble Truths. That is the cause of the karma formations. If you could only know, realize that all that you're doing is just creating more suffering in the world, you'd stop. And in that stopping, there the karma formations stop. So with your eyes, now, where does the delusion come from? It comes with the arising of the taints, the asavas. There's the arising of delusion. This word asava, the taints, it literally means the mind going out into the world, the outflowings of the mind. It's when you go out into the world, the mind goes out into the world to play. That creates a delusion. So, we'll say in a few minutes about why the mind goes out. If you can stay at home and go inside and see what real happiness is inside, see what real peace is inside, and never thinking that happiness lies somewhere in the future or somewhere outside this moment, then you'll understand the craving which thinks that happiness can be somewhere else other than here, other than now. So it's the asavas are the cause here of delusion, or rather the fuel of delusion. With the arising of the taints as the arising of delusion, with cessation of the taints as cessation of delusion, the way in the cessation of delusion is the Noble Eightfold Path. When noble disciples thus understood delusion, its origin, cessation, way into its cessation, they can here and now make an end of suffering. They can abandon the underlying tendencies to greed, delusion, and the conceit I am. So what are these taints? The monks delighted rejoice in the Venerable Sariputta's words. Is there another way you can describe right view? Yes, there is. When friends, a noble disciple understands the asavas, these taints, their origin, cessation, the way into the cessation, in that way they can be called one of right view, whose view is straight, who has perfect confidence in the Dharma and has arrived at this true Dharma. What are the taints? What's their origin, cessation, the way into the cessation of the taints? There are these three taints, the taint or the outgoing of sensory desire, the outgoing of the mind of being. You go out into the world to be or to experience sensory pleasure, or the outgoing of the mind of ignorance, of delusion, just because, not for any particular purpose, just because one is stupid. With the arising of delusion, there's the arising of the asavas. With the cessation of delusion, there's the cessation of the asavas. And the way leading to the cessation of the asavas is just this Noble Eightfold Path. That is right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. You can see there in this whole causal sequence, they said the cause of delusion is the taints, and the cause of the taints is delusion. Obviously, when you go into any causal sequence, you have to come to some point just where you have to sort of find a little circle. Otherwise, there can never be any first cause. So these two things support each other. In another expression of this dependent origination, the Buddha actually stopped mentality, materiality, and consciousness, saying these two support each other. So he went from mentality, materiality being caused by consciousness, and consciousness being caused by mentality, materiality. The screen causes the image on the screen causes the screen. You can't have one without the other. And which comes first is just a chicken and egg thing. So that's why they have a circular beginning. So, there we got the asavas. When a noble disciple thus understood the asavas, the origin of the asavas, the cessation of the asavas, and the way leading to their cessation, They entirely abandon the underlying tendency to lust, abolish the underlying tendency to aversion, extirpate the underlying tendency to the view and conceit I am, and by abandoning ignorance and arousing true knowledge, they here and now make an end of suffering, and that way too a noble disciple is one of right view, whose view is straight, who has perfect confidence in the Dhamma and has arrived at this true Dhamma. So, to sum it all up, in each one of these they use the fourfold framework of what the thing is, what its origin, its cause is, that it has a cessation, and what is the cause for its cessation. And each one of these, the Eightfold Path, causes these things to end. And the causal sequence, now we've gone from backwards, we have these outflowings of the mind, mind which goes out into the world. Any one of you who's been a meditator, you know how this works. You want to try and go inwards. But the mind is always going out to the past or to the future, always going out to the sounds outside. It's not the dog disturbs you, you disturb the dog. You go out into your body looking for something to distract yourself, out into thinking. It is the mind going outwards into the world. That's the whole process is called the asavas. And that sort of keeps on supporting delusion, because it's a delusion which doesn't actually see where this is all coming from. And it's a delusion creates the karma formations. Because of the not really understanding, one acts by body, speech and mind. And this is actually part of the creating the world, the karma. And here one creates the consciousness. In particular here, this has to be the consciousness of the future existence. Because with the cessation of these karma formations, consciousness ceases. And obviously, if you stop making karma, you don't suddenly become unconscious. But what you do do, by stop making karma, then this is your last life. It means when you pass away, there's no more consciousness. So this is obviously the consciousness which begins on the next birth. And with that consciousness, you have to have the objects of consciousness. The two have to come together. You can't be conscious without having something to be conscious of. You can't be conscious of something without having the consciousness. So these two coexist, always come together. And with consciousness and the objects of consciousness, you also have in the same moment a coexistence of the six sense bases, contact and feeling. So this isn't like a sequential cause. These things always have to come together. This is sensory experience. You have the object, the sense base, its objects, contact coming together, and with it the sensory experience, and the most important aspect of that sensory experience is whether you like it, you don't like it, or what's in between. And that, with the delusion, creates this craving, which is the fuel which makes existence, where you get reborn in your next life, and you get the old age and suffering in your next life. You get reborn because you create your rebirth. You want to, and actually you do a lot of creating the world in which you get reborn into. And this is what dependent origination is talking about. And once you get reborn into that realm, then you have, what's the next one? Aging and death. Four noble truths. Nutriments, wholesome and unwholesome things, which you do. So understanding this is, the heart of this talk was on the dependent origination and actually how this whole universe keeps on going. And in particular, one of the points which I've made very often, the reason why we have the teaching of dependent origination, it shows how rebirth happens, this whole causal sequence, cause and effect, and there is no soul or self which is reborn. It just explains a process of reincarnation without a soul, as a cause and effect mechanism or process. Now, that was a very deep sutta, and I must admit to rushing through it, because I know the time constraints. We've been going for an hour and almost 50 minutes. Nevertheless, I hope I've given a fair representation in the time which I've had. Are there any comments or questions about this very deep and important sutta? Hmm? Yeah. Yeah. Okay, the reason is because it makes a lot of sense. Sort of makes sense. And is much of it which is according to your experience. But again, it is just like the old story of the tadpole in the water. Hearing sort of a frog give this great dissertation on dry land and the nature of water, it all seems very reasonable and logical. But until the tadpole actually gets out of the lake and goes on dry land, it's only then they can understand, this is what it all means. So it does need actually the case of the tadpole growing into a frog and leaving the water. And that simile is precisely what describes the experience when you get into a deep meditation, you get into a jhana, and you leave the world which you've been accustomed to. And that's why the way leading to cessation of all these things is not listening to it being described by Ajahn Brahm. Even listening to it being described by Venerable Sariputta was not enough. Practicing the Eightfold Path is the way that these teachings are actualized and penetrated. So the study is important. It gives you the map. But it doesn't allow all these things to cease. It doesn't give the end of ignorance or delusion. Delusion is ended by the Eightfold Path. That's why it is all the time. Buddhism has never been a scholastic religion. I think somebody mentioned this in a talk I gave, I think, in Adelaide. When I gave a talk about fundamentalism and just why there's so much violence. And they made a very valid point. Say, in religions which are run by scholars, you will always have extremists. But in religions which are run by practitioners, then you'll have a moderate religion. It's fascinating. You know, when you go to Bible school or what's it called, the madrasas, the colleges, and that's all you're doing, you're just learning. But you're not really sort of practicing these teachings. Then you'll have some extremism. And here, you... Yeah. Hmm. Yeah. But you just get in. We do, because we're having a retreat next month. The weekend retreat, the 9-day retreats, that's where you put an end to all this suffering business. Because that's where you can really do the Eightfold Path full on. You can actually practice jhanas in those retreats, because there's nothing else in your way. So that's why that study is really important, but the tradition in which I was brought up, they say the books are great, but the practice is more important. Ajahn Chah's simile was the teachings like this, it's like the sweet at the end of the meal, like the pudding. But if that's all you eat, just pudding or ice cream or apple pie, you're going to be a very, very sick person. You have to have the main course, and the main course is your practice. Is what you actually do, your restraint of your senses, the sitting meditation, keeping precepts, giving selfless service. So that is the main course of spiritual life. The study is the sweet which comes afterwards. It's a very nice simile. Yes, Kanchana. It is craving to annihilate. I don't think it's craving to annihilate your being so much. It's just... is it craving to be? I think it actually comes from a sense of self, a craving to be, in a perverse way. But certainly, wherever it actually comes from, what type of craving, you can identify that in your own life. Whenever people make a mistake, they feel so sorry, they basically go up to someone, sort of, "No, I'm so sorry, punish me." And sometimes you feel you need to be punished. And if they won't do it for you, you just deny yourself, your chocolate cake today or something. You think you don't deserve it. Whatever else it is. The idea of punishment and guilt is so strong in human beings. And it can be that strong. Guilty people will send themselves to hell. Even in this life. Was it that case that Dennis told me that during the first Iraq war, it was the second Gulf War, because he was working with Samaritans. He was there on the phones overnight, and this one guy, this English guy, called him, who was in Perth. He was the inventor of the cluster bomb. And he'd just seen on the news, in the first Gulf War, second Gulf War, whichever it was, he saw the effects of his invention. Can you imagine just how he would feel? And he was in hell. And he would not forgive himself. He wanted to be, obviously, if he'd have died at that moment and committed suicide, he would have sent himself to hell when he saw the effect of his invention, of his little boy's toys. It's okay in the laboratory making a big bang. And I remember as a kid making a bomb with my friend Christopher Nightingale, I still remember his name, in our local park. We thought it was great fun. But making something go bang. But you can see where that could lead. And then this guy went all the way to a cluster bomb and only realized when he saw it on the TV what that thing actually did. My goodness. Can you imagine just what people do and how much suffering that can be for them, and how they can send themselves to hell if they don't know how to forgive. The remorse actually is a hindrance. Restlessness and remorse is actually a hindrance. It's not a good thing, according to Buddhism. So what the Buddha said is to actually acknowledge, make amends, and just let go and forgive. I think the words are, he said, well, these are the many, many times, like when people came to kill him, to assassinate him. And they couldn't assassinate him, and they said, we came here to kill you, but we just can't do this. We've done a terrible thing. He said, if you acknowledge your mistake, you make amends, they call that growth in the Aryan tradition. So he never had a punishment. That's why the monastic rules, there's no punishments there at all. Whatever you do as a monk, you never get 50 lashes or anything. It's just, and this was like a very 2600 year old penal code for monks. Whereas I think in like the Benedictine orders or these Trappist orders, they'd be whipping each other. And doing penances, fasting for 10 or 20 days. But you don't have that at all in this very ancient system of law for a monastic order. That's actually quite remarkable. Where everyone else, even the secular system around the time of the Buddha, that all had these rewards and punishments. But the Buddha said no, it's completely out of kilter with the social mores of the time. It really stands out, no punishment at all. Which is amazing. It's not really a punishment. It's not like harming or hurting a person. You can't be a monk now, but you can still be a novice or a lay person. But you can't be a monk or a nun. So it's not really like a punishment. You're not sort of like sent to Coventry or never going to be a Buddhist. You're not excommunicated. You're okay. You can no longer be a full monk. But you can sometimes, they're a novice monk. They can still stay in the monastery. But they can't be the full monk again. Yes. And it becomes from the sense of a self. The sense that this is me in here who's wrong, faulty, not good enough, who needs to be punished. All comes from the sense I am. When that's completely abandoned for the stream winning, then there's no point to it anymore. What do you want to punish? Who are you going to punish anyway? What's that going to do? It's just going to make more problems, not less. But that goes against the way of the world, like many of the things we do here. But it was fascinating that the Buddhist monastic code just didn't have punishments. Certainly not physical punishments. Even actually that once these young novices in the time of the Buddha, some of them misbehaved, just like young boys want to do. And some of the monks told them to stay in their room and didn't allow them to eat. And the Buddha really told the monks, no, you can't do that. That's a punishment which you don't allow for little novices. So you can't hit the novices, you can't stop them eating. So basically you just have to try in other ways to guide them into amending their behavior. There is not even a punishment of denying them food or putting one bread and water or something. Yeah, but again, it's amazing just how many people actually do believe in karma, but still sort of make mistakes and do harmful things. You know, sometimes what the reason is, you know, is that craving, that delusion, the craziness, where, you know, you just forget. That's why, you know, like lust is a blindness. You are crazy. That's why you've got to be very careful, because if a person starts getting into lust, they can actually stop it before it's too bad, but once it gets that big, you are out of your mind. And you may have a beautiful partner, and you really love her or him, but you just can't stop yourself when you get to a certain point. You're crazy. So, you know, this is why passion is craziness. Okay, we can go on for a long time, but it's 5 o'clock now, and it's 2 hours, and I've got a monastery to go back to, and you've got a home to go to as well.